and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, after attacking two countries already in 2026, will the Trump administration also attack Cuba? What is Cuba's relationship to the United States historically and today? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The Trump administration changed the name of the Department of Defense to the Department of War. This indicated a desire to wage aggressive wars, and wage aggressive wars it has. The U.S. attacked Venezuela and seized President Nicolas Maduro, then, along with Israel, launched an aggressive war against Iran. When the president and his supporters are then asked what happens after Iran, frequently they will say, Cuba's next. So, in anticipation of a potential military aggression war waged against Cuba, we're going to spend the hour exploring the island nation's history, particularly its history with the United States, its government, its economy, outstanding issues that are tied to the Cuban Revolution and the decades of the Cuban government's relations with the U.S., and why is the U.S. targeting Cuba? Our panel today is Richard Feinberg. He is Professor Emeritus of International Political Economy at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Open for Business, Building the New Cuban Economy. William Leogrand is Professor of Government at American University in Washington. He's the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Guillermo Grenier is Professor of Sociology in the Department of Global and Sociocultural Studies at Florida International University. He's the author of This Land is Our Land, Newcomers and Established Residents in Miami. And Sebastian Arcos is Interim Director of the Cuban Research Institute at the Florida International University. He was part of the Freedom House delegation to the UN Human Rights Commission and advised the U.S. Department of State on issues concerning human rights in Cuba during the Clinton administration. I want to thank you all so very much for joining us, an incredibly esteemed panel. Richard Feinberg, I'll ask you the first question. The president in U.S. policy seems to want to target senior leadership, arresting Maduro, killing Ali Khamenei. Who exactly is the senior leadership in Cuba? Who is governing Cuba?
Yeah, well, thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me here. So people, when they think of Cuba, they might think of Fidel Castro, who was very much a charismatic leader. But he, starting back in the 1960s, decided to, quote, institutionalize the revolution. And by that, I mean he wanted it to be not just a one-man show, but rather a regime which would govern the country in a broad-based way. And that's when he aligned with and brought in the Cuban Communist Party, which was there. His brother had been a member, but it was fairly small. Over the many decades, he built up the party, and it is now a party, and this is a critical point, a collective leadership party that governs Cuba. Now, the Cuban Communist Party is closely linked at the highest levels to the military, which itself was a creation of the revolution, the FAR, the armed forces of the revolution. So it's some combination of the intertwined forces of an established hierarchical military and a Cuban Communist Party, both of whom are presumably very loyal to the revolution. That's all they've ever known. This is now three generations on, and it's very much of a collective leadership. They very much have this idea, we stand together or we hang together. So the idea that there's some easy picking, as there seemed to have been in the Maduro case in Venezuela, would absolutely not apply.
And William Leogrand, to that end, what are the grievances that the U.S. would have against Cuba? What could be a justification for a U.S. attack on Cuba?
Well, you have to remember that the United States had an embargo against Cuba for the past 67 years. That's because initially Cuba defied us and aligned itself with the Soviet Union. So that during the Cold War, there was some good reason for the United States to see Cuba as an adversarial state. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuba really hasn't posed an enormous threat to the United States. And in fact, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Cubans have been interested in trying to have a better relationship because they recognize that having a normal economic and political relationship with the United States is really essential for their path of development. Of course, there's still a communist political system, and that's an issue for the United States. It was an issue for every president right up through Donald Trump. It was an issue for Joe Biden, which I think is why he decided not to go back to pursuing the policy of normalization that President Barack Obama set in motion in 2014. Whenever Cuba and the United States sit down to negotiate, there are always a handful of issues that are on the agenda. The issue of prisoners, of course, political prisoners. And generally, when relations are improving, the Cubans have been willing to release political prisoners. There's the issue of claims, the claims that people in the United States have from the property that was nationalized at the time of the revolution. And then there's also Cuban-American claims, which are different. But these are claims that people who were Cuban citizens at the time came to the United States and became naturalized and have claims for the property they lost, which we have legislation now in the United States that lets them sue in federal court anybody who's using that old property.
We're going to dig into that in much more detail as the show goes on. But Guillermo Grenier, I want to raise an obvious question. Whenever anybody asks me about U.S. policy towards Cuba, immediately I think of electoral politics and the impact of Cuban Americans in Florida. How much is American policy and the potential of an attack, of a toppling of the government, driven by the interests of lots of Cuban American voters, in particularly in Florida, but obviously throughout the country?
I'm going to be a contrarian on this, Doug, because usually there's a de facto belief, a stereotype, if you wish, that the Cuban-American population in South Florida specifically, because Florida is such an important electoral state, that that population is driving U.S. policy towards Cuba. And, you know, at any one instance, there is a potential where the Cuban vote might make a difference, less so than back in the year 2000, for example, when George Bush won a national presidency with 537 votes from Florida. And that you could say that 537 Cubans elected him. I mean, or Elian, you can just narrow it down to one Cuban. You can just say Elian Gonzalez elected him. But the reality of the dynamics is that I tend to think that the U.S. has a belief. Cuba has not been important enough for the United States. In general, Cuba is not an important issue. And that allows it to be ignored. That allows it to be kind of considered within the context of electoral politics. But I think ultimately it's because the U.S., for like Dr. Leo Grandi has said, that for many, many years, it was a hostile relationship that was developed. And when that is no longer the reality, you say, well, it's the Cuban-American votes that are deciding foreign policy in the United States. I think the U.S. foreign policy is decided by U.S. foreign interests. It's just that Cuba has never played much into that, except lately, because it's weak. Now, Cuba is important for the United States on interest on another level, which is migration. And that is one of the areas where the importance of Cuba has been maintained over the years, because for one reason or another, migration from Cuba has always been like a faucet where you turn it on, it gushes out, and then you try to close it, but it leaks. It leaks all the time. There's been a constant migration of Cubans from 1959. And that has been an issue with the United States for the longest time. And since COVID, you've had 648,000 Cubans come over the border because the Cuban economy completely have flatlined. And so, yes, Cuban American vote's important. It was more, and right now, Florida is a red state. It doesn't depend on Cuban Americans to make it so. So I think that the canard that, well, the Cuban Americans are guiding U.S. foreign policy, it's going to have to stop at some point. I think a lot of things are going to stop this year, evidently. But the important thing is that no, Cuban Americans have been, as we say in Spanish, se le tiramos el muerto. We threw the body of the cadaver has been thrown on the body of Cuban Americans and blame them for running U.S. foreign policy. The reality is that U.S. foreign policy has not considered Cuba a real issue for many, many years.
I think it's a great, great point. And Sebastian Arcos, I want to bring you in as well, because although I am skeptical that human rights tends to be at the top or even near the top of the list of American interests, particularly in interventions, Cuba does have quite the spotty human rights record. Is it fair to say that you could make a case that the Cuban government's policies on human rights could justify a demand for regime change?
Absolutely. I would justify it. It's not just a spotty record. It's a horrendous record of 67 years with thousands of executions, tens of thousands of political prisoners, millions of exiles, a repression that today has over 1,200 political prisoners in jail, more than Venezuela, which is three times larger than Cuba in population. That alone should be enough for the United States to pressure the regime for change. But it's not the one only thing. It is true that Cuba doesn't represent a military threat to the United States right now. The Cuban military is obsolete. However, 10 years after the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States arrested its highest top foreign agent in the United States, and he was a Cuban agent. So Cuba represents still a threat to the United States in an asymmetric way. Migration has been, as Guillermo pointed out, a way which Cuba has used to blackmail essentially the United States into making concessions. Clinton is the prime example of that. He had to sign an agreement, migration agreement, the only country at the time, I think, in history that ever had a floor, that is a minimum of migrants entering the United States year after year, was Cuba. That was a huge concession given by the Clinton administration. And I have to agree with Guillermo. Cubans, unfortunately, don't have the strength to change the electoral politics, so they cannot set foreign policy. And the evidence is there. Cubans were not happy with Clinton. There was nothing they could do. Remember, Guillermo, when they blocked the I-36 in protest for the agreement, and then the Elian protest,
Yeah.
there was nothing they could do. When Obama decided to switch the policy 180 around, Cubans were not happy, and yet there was nothing they could do. So at most, there are periods of agreement with Washington and periods of disagreement with Washington.
Yeah, and Guillermo, you and Sebastian both raised an issue. I know what you're talking about. I want to make sure the listeners know. What exactly is the Elian Gonzalez? You made that reference to Elian Gonzalez. Remind our listeners who we're talking about.
Yeah, Elian Gonzalez is a case from November 1999 to April of 2000, where a young boy was found on Thanksgiving Day in the waters off Florida alone, and his mother had died on the way over on a raft trying to leave Cuba. He was the only survivor. There were two other survivors, but he was the only one of the family that survived. And he was taken in, and he made his home in Miami at a house in Little Havana for those distant relatives. And from the beginning, the relatives wanted to keep Elian here. And from the beginning, the father in Cuba wanted to have Elian back. So it became, instead of a custody issue, it became a national, international issue. Ultimately, Elian did go back. And the only reason it took so long is because it was Cuba and the United States. Because one thing that I was going to add to what Sebastiano maybe adjust a little bit, what Sebastian said is that it's true. Everything's a problem between Cuba and the United States. Migration, you had to have an agreement. And yes, it was the only one. Cuba was the only country that had a quota at that point in time. But it's because Cuba and the United States have not had normal relations. If you had had normal relations between two countries from the beginning of after the revolution, those kinds of things would have different dynamics. The US, Mexico is a much more of a threat to the United States in immigration than Cuba will ever be. And they, you know, they sit down and they deal with it. Now, I think that a lot of the isomorphism that Sebastian referred to, because we don't have relations, and it's because the U.S. doesn't give Cuba any kind of importance, except for Obama. He's the point that proves my argument. It gives evidence to the argument that when the United States wants to do something, it will do it, regardless of what Cuban Americans think. And the opinion of the Cuban Americans when Obama had the openings towards Cuba did not change. There weren't right wingers that were all of a sudden becoming, you know, dialogueros, wanted to have a dialogue with Cuba. The opinions of the Cuban Americans did not change. What changed were the rules of the game. And the rules of the game then forced the Cuban Americans to deal with Cuba in a different way. And as an extremely conservative colleague of mine once told me, once Obama changed the rules of the game, now his idea was he still hated the Cuban government, but what he wanted to do was then contribute to creating a middle class, quote, so that the middle class could stir the pot and create problems for the government that then the government will be forced to deal with and therefore change. Now, that might be utopic, that might be naive or whatever. But once the rules of the game changed, the Cubans were then part of that game. They were playing in a different sandbox.
Richard Feinberg, I was going to turn to you. I know you've written about this question. So
So I think what Guillermo is getting at is really the critical question about what is the best method to bring about gradual change in Cuba. And the traditional position was somehow really squeeze them, embargo them, beat them up, and somehow that will produce change. That went on for over 50 years. The Cuban Communist Party still remained completely in control. So Obama comes in and he says, you know what, keep beating our head against this. Let's try a different approach. And his approach, which by the way, was tremendously popular in Cuba, I have to say, I was there. I was there when Obama made the announcement. I was there when he visited the island. Massively popular among the most Cuban people, maybe not with the Cuban Communist Party necessarily at the top levels, but with the people in the streets. And his view was, all right, look, why don't we engage with reduce tensions, create economic relationships, solve the issue of property claims gradually over time. This will produce a more relaxed atmosphere on the island, and there'll be more interchange with Americans, with tourists, and also, as was being said, a private sector would gradually emerge. That over time would produce, we can't be sure exactly what, but would be likely to produce a more open, pluralistic system. And I would maintain that although Obama was only doing this for 2 years before Trump came in, Trump won, that actually that approach was bearing fruit, both in terms of relaxation of politics on the island and a gradual opening economically, and also discussions between the United States and Cuba on a whole slew of security issues. But Trump came back and he decided, this wasn't necessarily predetermined, he decided to ally himself with the most hardline elements in the Cuban American community. And he decided to completely go back to the old policies, which produced the stalemate that we're at today. Again, with the difference that the island now is more impoverished, that 1.5 to 2 million Cubans have left in the last 5 or so years. And think about that. 15 to 20% of the population has left, including the youngest, the best, and the brightest have left the island. Think about what a disaster that is for everyone concerned. Roughly half a million of those people are here in Florida, by the way, where I am right now, and in neighboring areas. So we have already produced a massive migration crisis with this stranglehold that we're it doesn't seem we're any closer to our goal of a more open, progressive, mixed economy than we had been before we beat the crap out of them and forced almost 15 to 20% of their population to exit the island. So it's been such a humanitarian disaster. And to think that Trump seems to think, okay, let's squeeze them even harder. Like, is there no learning going on here?
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the current conditions in Cuba, the future of Cuba, will the U.S. attack, and what that means for Cuba. Our guests today are Richard Feinberg. He's from the University of California at San Diego. William Leo Grande from the American University in Washington. Guillermo Grenier from Florida International University. And Sebastian Arcos, also from Florida International University. William, I want to bring you in on this question because you've done some research and written, obviously, about negotiations between the U.S. and Havana. We kind of have grown accustomed to believe that confrontation, the U.S. trying to topple the government, you know, through the use of sanctions, blockades, etc., is the only relationship the United States has had with Cuba. Is that true, that that's the only relationship? And can this be resolved diplomatically?
So certainly confrontation and coercion from the United States has been the dominant theme in the relationship ever since Fidel Castro rolled into Havana in 1959. But there's been a sub-theme as well, as presidents of the United States have recognized that there are issues that can't be solved without talking to Cuba. Almost every one of them has, at one point or another, opened dialogue with the Cuban government. Sometimes it's been about very specific issues, like migration, as we were talking about earlier, or cooperation in counter-narcotics operations, or environmental protection in our common sea border. But other times, it's been an effort to try to normalize the relationship overall. President Kennedy was the first to initiate that, came to an end when he was assassinated. President Carter, President Gerald Ford, when Henry Kissinger was his Secretary of State, opened some initial negotiations with Cuba about normalization. That came to an end as a result of Cuba's active involvement in the Angolan Civil War. President Carter picked up that same portfolio and tried without success. And then finally, of course, President Obama was able to reach an agreement with Cuba to restore diplomatic relations. And I just want to underscore what Richard said about how successful that was in a very short period of time. Just 2 years left in Obama's last term of office, Cuba and the United States signed 22 bilateral agreements on issues of mutual interest. More diplomatic progress, frankly, than we made in the relationship in the previous 50 or 60 years. You know, Obama's critics who say, well, that was a terrible thing. He never should have done that. The United States didn't get anything out of it. I think are flatly wrong. We got at least 22 bilateral agreements, and there's a number of other things I think the United States achieved with that. But the critics are attacking a policy that only lasted 2 years before it was reversed and advocating instead that we return to a policy that hasn't worked in 60 years.
And Sebastian, you had some thoughts on this question as well. I'll bring you in.
Yeah, this is something that comes up every time. And is it the inclination to blame what happens in Cuba on U.S. policy? Cuba has had plenty of opportunities to reform on its own economy or politics as they wish to do, and they have never decided to do that. They had an opportunity in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. They didn't take it. Then they had an opportunity when Chavez came in and replaced part of the Soviet subsidy, and the Cuban economy leveled off. They didn't do it. Then they had finally the best opportunity during the Obama years, which, by the way, lasted four, not 2 years. And I must remind everyone that the cruise companies going to Cuba lasted all the way to 2019. And 2019 was the year when Cuba had record tourist numbers, including, of course, Americans traveling to Cuba. They have never done it because they are not interested in it. They have a very orthodox perspective on economics. And when I say they, I really mean Raul Castro, who's the man running the show. I'm sorry to disagree with Dr. Feinberg, but Cuba always was a one-man show, first during Fidel Castro and now during Raul. The party leadership that we see, the president, the prime minister, is merely a facade of power. The real power resides in the armed forces, which were molded by Raul Castro since 1959, when he became the head of the armed forces in Cuba. And they don't only have the guns, they also have the bank accounts. They are the true power behind the party. The party is a hollow shell. It has always been a hollow shell that Fidel Castro first and then Raul have used to justify their own personal power. Cuba is a very opaque, very hierarchical, typical totalitarian society. And all totalitarian societies tend to have that kind of political structure. They're usually one man at the top. Usually, it's one man at the top. And Cuba is not different. It's only, interesting enough, different in the sense that the party no longer runs the country. It is the military that does. Mm-hmm. And the party appears to be that ruling power with a civilian face, with a non-Castro last name. But actually, it is the military under Raul that still runs the country. So it's not broken Cuba because of U.S. policy. Therefore, the fix is not just changing U.S. policy. The fix is convincing a very obdurate leadership that it's important to make, for their own sake, economic and political reforms.
But Richard, I want to give you a chance to respond.
I completely agree with his last statement there. If it were just Raul, maybe it would be easy to cut a deal. And I think that's what Obama was sort of trying to do. And what happened was that Raul found that many people in his government, in the Communist Party, in the bureaucracy, in the state-owned enterprises, actually were not that interested in economic reform. And they blocked him, contrary to the idea that maybe he's an all-powerful totalitarian. Where are we now today? Okay, today the government is really hurting, the economy is on the ground. Perhaps there are enough people now in the apparatus, in the senior levels of the Communist Party, in the bureaucracy, the state-owned enterprises, that will have decided, you know what? It is in our interest to actually open up the economy. It is in our interest to pay off the debts to claimants in the United States. It is in our interest to privatize some of the state-owned enterprises. It is in our interest to completely revamp the agricultural sector, which has been a complete collapse and a complete failure. So there is an opportunity now for the Trump administration to sit down with the Cubans and say, all right, we got you now. You know, we have the leverage. We got you on the ground. Are you prepared now to move forward with these serious systemic economic reforms? If they agree to that, though, and Marco Rubio did seem to indicate that he was willing to do this without immediate political liberalization, this is the key. That was the Communist Party would still hold the levers of political power. But economically, there would be a major reform, a major opening to U.S. investors, to diaspora investors, to local private enterprise. If the Cubans are willing to cut that deal, that could only succeed if the U.S. lifts economic sanctions, because you're not going to get significant foreign investment coming in a country that's under U.S. economic sanctions. Who's going to invest in such an uncertain and risky environment, right? So is the administration, is the Cuban-American community willing to reciprocate with saying, yes, if you actually take all those measures, not just promises, show us you're actually going to move ahead with those measures, then yes, we will open up our economy to promote growth in Cuba.
When we come back, Cuban Americans and the U.S. have argued that compensation for property loss since the Cuban Revolution justifies sanctions and a potential attack. What are the issues of appropriation and compensation on Cuba? Stay with us.
Everything in life is a negotiation.
Thank you.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. President Obama believed that economic reforms in Cuba would lead to political reforms. Others argued that political reforms need to come first. What are the political and economic issues for Cuba, and do they need reforming? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Richard Feinberg. He's from the University of California at San Diego. William Leogrande, he's at American University in Washington. Guillermo Grenier, he is at Florida International University. And Sebastian Arcos, he is also at Florida International University. William, historically, there has been these contentious issues about property being seized, and questions about the legality, illegality. First of all, what's the history of, you know, these property issues, these property conflicts and claims between Cuba and the United States?
As U.S.-Cuban relations broke down in 1959 and into 1960, the United States nationalized about $1 billion worth of United States companies and individuals' investment. With accumulated interest, that's a claim that the United States has for about $1.8 billion in compensation. Shortly after nationalizing U.S. property on the island, the Cuban government socialized the entire economy, nationalizing the property of all Cuban-American businesses. So, of course, there are Cuban-Americans who have property claims, but these are very different kinds of claims. The Cuban government acknowledges that it owes some level of compensation to the U.S. property owners who were dispossessed. And during the Obama administration, there was even the beginnings of a dialogue about how to resolve those claims. The Cuban government does not recognize that the United States, at least, has any role, any legitimate role, in advocating on behalf of Cuban-American claimants, because they were Cuban citizens at the time. And so the Cuban government nationalized Cuban property of Cuban-American citizens. But Cuban Americans have those claims, and there's the 1996 Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act that allows them to sue people using their old property in U.S. federal court for damages. The other thing is that I think it would behoove the Cuban government to think about ways to address Cuban American property claims, because Cuban Americans are the external investors most likely to go back and reinvest in the island, particularly under the current very difficult economic circumstances. Cuba today is a, as Richard was saying, is a high-risk investment environment. The average investor who's just looking to make a profit is not going to go back to Cuba for a few years, I think. Cuban Americans have an emotional attachment to the island, and many of them are actually investing right now as silent partners through the channel of remittances. And as the Cuban private sector has grown, and it has grown substantially in the last few years, a lot of the seed capital that's gone into those businesses has come from Cuban Americans. And the supply chain for those businesses stretches back to Miami, where Cuban American partners are helping on this end. So the claims are contentious. They've always been on the U.S. negotiating agenda. Cuba doesn't yet recognize the Cuban American claims, but it would be wise for them to do so.
Richard, what's the likelihood that this could be managed, and either managed not as a result of an attack on Cuba, but through negotiations? And how much would a U.S. attack on Cuba complicate or ease the resolution of some of these claims?
Well, the United States has negotiated many claims, disputes with many countries over the years. Cuba has negotiated claims, disputes with other countries, actually, also arising from the revolution. So it is certainly doable. And there are any number of formulas that you can imagine for resolving this. There could be a lump sum payment whereby the Cubans just pay the $2 billion. They could borrow the money or whatever, or issue bonds. Now, that's one way to go. They can do debt equity swaps. They can do some direct restitution. There are lots of ways to skin this cat. So it is definitely doable. if there's a political will to do that on both sides. And that's the key fact. The Cubans recognize the compensation. They've always, even Fidel Castro said, yeah, I recognize compensation, but as a principle. But then they throw up all sorts of conditions. Yeah, we'll pay you for the properties, but you got to pay us for the damage that you did in your counter-revolutionary activities and the cost of the embargo. And that's way in excess of this $2 billion. So the Cubans, if they want to settle this, are going to have to get realistic, are going to have to drop all those counterclaims and make good on these payments. That would indicate, I think, very importantly to the United States, that, okay, this time we're moving beyond rhetoric. We're really serious. We want to establish property rights, because that's what this is all about. It's about property rights. And by paying off the $2 billion, yeah, we recognize and we will respect in going forward property rights. And that will help attract new investors. So this is all about really laying the foundations for a more healthy and prosperous business climate for private sector investors, Cuban, international, American, on the island. It's absolutely critical. That's what makes this important. And the Cubans, I wrote a paper on this about 10 years ago, and the Cubans kept saying, Richard, why are you making such a big deal about this stuff? This happened like decades and decades ago, and most of these people are long since dead anyway. I said, guys, you got to grasp the principle here. And the United States is a global capitalist power, and therefore we have to recognize and seek a general recognition of the importance of property rights. Mm-hmm. So this is an issue in Cuba, but it's also a global issue for the United States.
Guillermo, I always wrestle with this question, especially if the U.S. is threatening to attack Cuba. Is there an expectation on the part of the Cuban-American community of some of forms of restitution? Or is this something that most Cubans living in the United States realize, I mean, this has happened decades ago, and there shouldn't be any sort of expectation?
Well, you really like this attack idea, don't you, Doug?
Do I like it? No. Do I think it's going to happen? I'm fearful.
Yeah, I'm scared that, you know, the fact that it's not going as he planned in Iran, he might decide to take some low-hanging fruit. But I think that the big picture is this. There are Cubans and there are Cubans. There are Cubans that have, I came over with my parents in the 60s. They're both gone. And most Cubans that came along at that time are either gone or they're like me, you know, talking about their parents who are gone. And so you have this old guard of Cubans that actually have memories of the island, the houses they lived in, etc. So you have that group. And then you have Cubans, which is the majority of the population now, that have come since 1995 and 683,266 have come since 2022. And to the United States. And like Richard said, it's 2 million overall migration during that period of time. So those Cubans have different expectations about property or even a sense of what property is than the Cubans that came earlier. The earlier Cubans that have had a house in Havana, had a house in Pinal del Rio, had a house in Santiago, most of them are not going to go back and demand that house back. That's just a fact. It's not going to happen. Now, there'll be some outliers that decide to go that route, but they'll find very little support in a totally restructured legal system, which would have to happen for that even to become a semi-reality. Productive properties, whether they be the U.S.-owned properties or not, are a different thing. If you had properties in Cuba that were either confiscated or that now have become productive properties, and they were used to be your properties, I've heard people talk about, I want that property back because like, I can invest in it and I can make it all that it can be. I can have it live its best life. So I think you'll have the only thing for sure is that American citizens will be able to have within the legal structure access to some kind of payback for that property. Whether that actually happens or not, Cuba has no money. You have to go from that. And it has to be, you have to have a creative kind of financial structure to even pretend to pay back anybody's money. Now, the Spaniards have done something interesting. They've also had to have seen their properties totally go underwater in Cuba and the Cuban government hasn't complied with a lot of their agreements. But the Spanish government has just passed within the last month a new accord with Cuba saying, okay, you don't have to pay us back. You owe us a lot of money, but you don't have to pay us back. But we want a piece of the profits, and then we're going to run those businesses as we see fit. And the Cubans have agreed to pay a percentage of what they hope will be a growing pie to the people that are helping the Spaniards, who are helping the pie get bigger. So something like that with the United States might work and might actually create enough capital to have Cuba think about either paying somebody back or investing in something. Because what's real is that Cuba has any improvement in the Cuban economy is going to come from abroad. And like Bill said, the ones that are committed to seeing that happen beyond the capitalistic motive of all capitalists are Cuban Americans. So some special attention has to be given by the Cuban government to what Cuban Americans want or need in order to entice them to invest in an economy that is going to require billions and billions of dollars before it can even crank up.
Yeah, and in that case, what makes that attractive to Cuba, I imagine, is that it's not about Cuba paying Spain as much as giving Spain the opportunity to invest and be able, that Spanish investors to make money off of Cuba. Is that correct?
Right,
Okay,
correct.
very good. So, and you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about Cuba. We're talking about the American threats to Cuba, the U.S. history, what Cuba might look like going into the future. Our guests today are Richard Feinberg of the University of California, San Diego, William Leogrande from American University, Guillermo Grenier from Florida International University, and Sebastian Arcos, also of Florida International University. And Sebastian, I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to this as well, this question about compensation or property rights, all the different issues that we've been raising.
I substantially agree with everything that has been said before. I think the main issue here, the most important thing to keep in mind, is that yes, Cuban Americans will be the first ones to go in because they have that emotional attachment, and many of them really sincerely want to help. I have been in meetings already where this idea of creating a collective pool of investment is beginning to be considered. However, there is a precondition that is necessary and inevitable for Cuban American money to flow into the island, and that is regime change. Within the current regime, with the current rules of the game, Cuban Americans, better than anybody else, understand that any money that goes in will never come out. It will happen. It has happened already to the Spaniards. It has happened to the Brits. It has happened to many who invested in Cuba. And in the end, the Cuban confiscated whatever investment they have made. So the rules of the game have to change. Property rights are fundamental. Transparency, banking rules, financial transactions, all that have to be changed before the money flows in. And inevitably, in order to do that, you need political change in the island. So the growing consensus in Miami is we love the idea of a transition, but the transition cannot start with economic reforms. It must start with political reforms because otherwise, economic reform is not possible.
And William, what we're describing here is changing the relationship between the US and Cuba, or even possibly a Cuban regime change. But what's coming out of the White House, that's not the image that we've been given. The image we've been given is the president saying, I can take Cuba, that maybe even suggesting, and I wonder if it's in jest, I actually don't know, about Marco Rubio could become, president of Cuba or something. Is that just rhetoric coming out of Washington, or do you think the conversations of policymakers are showing the level of nuance that we've been showing so far, for this hour?
I think the administration's biggest problem is that they don't really have a clear plan for what they're doing with Cuba. And I think that, frankly, is typical of a lot of their foreign policy. In the case of Cuba, when the president says he's looking forward to having the honor of taking Cuba, he does sound a little like William McKinley, who took Cuba back in 1898. And that didn't end so well, actually. But seriously, the administration is talking with Cuba today. We don't know quite what the agenda is. There have been some suggestions, even from Secretary Rubio, that the economic issues may actually be at the top of the U.S. agenda rather than the bottom. He said in an interview in St. Kitts that there had to be radical economic change on the island and political change eventually, he said. And that suggests to me that he and the president are looking at a model more like Venezuela, where the United States, it turned out, was most interested in opening up the Venezuelan economy and especially the oil sector to U.S. investors, and less interested in a transition back to democracy in Venezuela. And in fact, he said, you know, the reason that he was not supporting the opposition in Venezuela that had won the 2024 election was because he was afraid that if you just tore down the existing regime, you would get another Iraq in which you'd have chaos. One could make a similar sort of argument with regard to Cuba. Now, Cuba doesn't have oil, and so the economic issue is probably not as pressing in the Cuban case as it was in the Venezuelan case. And yet Cuba does have strategic minerals, and part of the president's policy is to deny strategic minerals to China. And Cuba has a well-developed, although right now in recession, tourism sector of its economy. And of course, the president's business before he was president was in hospitality, putting his name on hotels, owning golf courses, and so on. And twice before he became president, he sent representatives to Havana to see if there were some business opportunities for him on the island. So one could imagine that opening Cuba to the kind of economic reforms that Richard was talking about, and that even Sebastian was talking about, that are really, truly dramatic economic reforms that push Cuba in the direction of a Vietnam or a China, that might be attainable through these negotiations. But I think it's pretty clear that without any significant domestic organized political opposition on the island, the chance of getting the Cuban government to effectively commit political suicide across the bargaining table by agreeing to regime change is extremely unlikely.
Guillermo, you had made a comment about, you know, me focusing on the attack and everything. And I guess I have framed this as it seems like the attack might be inevitable. Can Cuba do anything that they'd be willing to do to avoid an attack and instead be able to negotiate their way into at least an easing of the sanctions, maybe even a lifting of the sanctions? Or does that require a regime change that the regime would never agree to?
Well, it takes two to tango, and the tune is unknown right now. I think that Cuba can't possibly, I mean, they are talking. I mean, let's start with that there are some adults in a room somewhere discussing this, let's hope. And it's not just a matter that can either be resolved with force or without force, that there's some nuanced areas there that can be negotiated. I think Bill has laid out, as has Sebastian and Richard, that the economic benefits that Cuba offer the United States are very limited. The tourism, et cetera, it's not a Venezuela situation where you can keep the government in place and you just want to make sure that the oil keeps pumping and you can then have more access to that resource. I don't think that's the scenario in Cuba, but I do think that tragically, and perhaps what makes all this very difficult, is that one thing that Cuba does have to negotiate is political change. Its political structure is on the table. Now, you will hear from the Cubans, the nationalistic expected defense of their sovereignty, and I think it should be defended. But the point is here that one of the few things that Cuba does have to offer is some kind of change that will placate the Cuban Americans that would like to go in and invest, and will somehow be a trophy for the Trump administration. So I think that we won't really know until some of these discussions come out of the closet to understand what is being discussed and to what degree political change is on the table. I think that Billy O'Brien laid it out. There is no structure beyond the structure that a lot of Cuban Americans are demanding be changed. So that's a tricky situation. Is it enough to get Raul, you know, out of the picture? Or Díaz-Canel is like low-hanging fruit. I would not be surprised if he's just thrown under the bus day after tomorrow as part of the negotiation strategy, because Díaz-Canel has never had the support of the people or support of the party. He was considered a pretty boy because he has a good head of hair, but he's never been a real motivator in the society. So it would not surprise me if he's like one of the first chits to be cashed in this negotiated political structure, because I do think there's going to have to be something given, because Cuba just doesn't have much to offer other than its own restructuring.
Mm-hmm. Let me just add, Doug, I think in terms of this issue of regime change, now here's where Trump is very good at sort of redefining a situation, right? So the Communist Party is going to remain in power. But if Díaz-Canel steps aside, and let's say there are significant changes in the cabinet, so we see, which is what Rubio asked for, he wanted to see a bunch of new faces. Well, I think most Cubans on the island would welcome a new cabinet with new faces, hopefully younger, more vigorous, more economically sophisticated folks that would have credibility with the private sector there and internationally and in Washington, D.C. So if regime change is suddenly defined as a new cabinet, okay, then I think we could be talking about that sort of political change. But the Communist Party would still be there, and we would not have democratic elections in the near term.
And by the way, that seems to be a suggestion they have in Iran. So there's a precedent to call just new faces mean regime change. Guillermo, you wanted to respond?
Yeah, I was going to kind of piggyback on a comment that I like to make. One is that I know that for Cuban Americans, a lot of Cuban Americans in Miami, especially the older ones that envision the whole Cuban society as being a one-man show or dominantly a one-man show. It's not to where the power is, but to where actually the one man running it. I think that new generations of Cubans that I've had the opportunity to interview dozens and dozens, maybe in the hundreds now, of Cubans, because I was in charge of this big, large project of hemispheric migration. And I've talked to hundreds of new Cubans that have come in this big wave. That's why I know practically the number that's come since 2022. And they could not care less if the Communist Party stays in power or doesn't stay in power. They're pissed off at the government, just like the early arrivals were pissed off at the government, but for different reasons. The new group is very upset with the government because they didn't deliver on their promises. They did not make a society that they could use their human resources to live in, that the only way that they can survive this world is to look at and leave. And they really hate the government for that. Now, when they get to Miami, hating the government for taking a country away or hating a government because it didn't deliver on the promises becomes one ball of hate. But I think that there are different types of perceptions of what would be acceptable to the Cuban people on the island. I think what Richard said is, I tend to agree. That is, the Cubans on the island really want that society to work. It is an incompetently run, bureaucratically, incredibly corrupt on the one hand, as well as authoritarian on the other. They don't like the way it's running. And plus, there's no economic opportunity. And that's like the cherry on top. Because if everything else were as it is, and that beat people up just because you went out and protested, but you could have a good job, your kids would be guaranteed a schooling, health care, everything would work, there'd be a lot of gray area there. But the point is that right now, if economic structures change, you would find a lot of Cubans on the islands will be very content with that, regardless of what we consider here to be an adequate or not adequate political transition.
Sebastian, I'm going to give you the last word. We have about 2 minutes left.
The problem is the Communist Party. I know that I said that the Communist Party today is a facade, but the idea of the Communist Party, the idea of centralized power, centralized economy, centralized everything, it's the problem in Cuba. They will not be a transformation into China starting today, because that train has left the station a long time ago. They should have used the Obama opening to do that. They missed the train. They have hyper-concentrated the economy in only a few sectors, mainly tourism, and only in few hands, mostly military. And to disengage what they have done and go all the way to Vietnam and China at this stage of the game, it's impossible.
Our panel today has been Richard Feinberg, a professor emeritus of international political economy at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Open for Business, Building the New Cuban Economy. William Leo Grande is professor of government at American University in Washington. He's the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Guillermo Grenier is professor of sociology in the Department of Global and Sociocultural Studies at Florida International University. He's the author of This Is Our Land, Newcomers and Established Residents in Miami. And Sebastian Arcos, he's interim director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University. He was on the UN Human Rights Commission and also advised the U.S. Department of State. I want to thank you all so much. Quite frankly, I feel confident saying a much more intelligent and nuanced conversation about Cuba than most that we're having in this country, with how important the island is, I believe, going to be in upcoming days. So thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.